I have a very important message for all of us today. We're in the fight of our lives when it comes to the impacts of climate change, and we need to continue to fight the good fight for our planet and all of its inhabitants. Are you still in for defeating the fossil fuel industry, winning pro-climate elections, and defending climate science? If so, please stay with me because I promise you this show is for you. Hello, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Today, we're going to talk about the miraculous hope of climate realists. Joining me is Erica Spanger Siegfried, lead climate analyst, Union of Concerned Scientists. Erica researches, she writes, and she speaks about U.S. climate change impacts and preparedness. She currently manages UCS's climate impacts analysis, work that helps shed light through new research, analysis, and outreach on ongoing climate change impacts, current efforts to cope with these impacts, and the urgency of strong leadership and action. Most recently, Erica has overseen UCS's leading edge work around sea level rise and coastal flooding, including encroaching tides, how sea level rise and tidal flooding threatens U.S. East and Gulf Coast communities over the next 30 years, and the U.S. military on the front lines of rising sea. In other words, Erica knows quite a bit about quite a lot when it comes to the true impact of climate change, probably up to and including right this minute. In December of 2018, she wrote a blog, an excerpt from which reads, "As 2018 wound down, science walloped us. The IPCC 1.5 degree report, the United States National Climate Assessment, and other scientific works were released with stark assertions about how things are and that they're all but lost. The things that we can fight for if we bring strongest ambitions to bear, and the waning gap between ambitions and where we are headed." Great reasons for giving up hope, right? In some ways, yes. But Erica goes on in that blog and does what I call takes us deeper. She goes on to give us reasons why we are all in for the fight of our lives. And she invites all of us to continue to fight like hell for this planet and all of its inhabitants, and that it's worth the fight. She invites us to ask ourselves if we are still in when it comes to defeating the fossil fuel industry, winning pro-climate elections. How important is that, everybody? Defending climate scientists and science and getting out in the streets for demonstrations. I am all in. And I agree with her conclusion. We've got that. We can do all that. Now let's hear from Erica. Erica, that was a long intro, but I had to do it. After reading all about you and talking to you a little bit the last time, I'm so excited to have you back, and I want to make it all about you from this point on.
Thank you, Gina. I'm really happy to be here talking with you today.
Okay. Your message and your work are important. So I want to do another quote, which I rarely read these many quotes, but another excerpt from that blog that was published in December. "We're stepping into a new year in the climate fight. The turning of the year is a milestone both for working, for stoking our resolve, and for noting how deep we are into climate overtime. In 2018, there was a lot of talk of diminishing odds and despair, and not without reason. So if you, like me, are heading into 2019 discouraged or even despairing, I have three things to say. You're not wrong. The fight from here on out is not the one you signed up for, but there's more to hope, even your own, than meets the eye. There's more to hope about." So fast forwarding today, it's so interesting to have read that blog again and again, and then to see we're in July, which is halfway through 2019. And my big question is, how are we doing? What blog would you write today to say, where are we?
Yeah, well, it's certainly been an interesting and challenging and even dangerous year from a climate change perspective already. From my vantage point, we've scarcely had time to stop and catch our breath. We've been watching the floods in the Midwest unfold and trying to make sense of that. We just recently, last week, released a report on the changing frequency of dangerous, even deadly, extreme heat days. And that went live just as this massive heat wave was unfolding across much of the country. So we're living these opening acts of climate change, and we're trying to make sense of it all and firm that resolve and find the ways to slow the problem even as we work to cope with it.
And there's days I wonder if you, Erica, say to the TV, which I do, and I'm limiting my TV watching these days because it keeps me filled with hope and the TV does not. Hey, people, you see that flooding? You see those lives destroyed? Do you see people who will die from extreme heat? It's not coming. It's here. This is what climate change looks like. This is the ugly face of climate change. Are you one of those nuts like me that says to the TV, please wake up. We need everybody.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes. Yep. So let's go ahead.
I even have to put myself on a radio news diet from time to time, take a couple of days off, but absolutely. And, you know, of course, when we release work like ours, we get pushback inevitably from folks who are in the climate denial stage. And I do find myself asking, you know, okay, fine. I don't intend to engage with you around this, but are you paying attention to what's happening out there? Because it's hard for me to reconcile how one could actually be paying attention to the things that are happening and still be holding on to those views.
That's exactly what I feel. It's like you can see it, you can measure it, it's being recorded. And I often think about the people that I've been talking with people a lot about. Where are they now? Because we have had some devastating things happen in this country. And recently, look what's happening in Puerto Rico. It's a volcano. I mean, it's erupting because things are still bad. People's lives are still devastated. And I was talking to one scientist who said he works all around. He works with the World Bank. And he said, Gina, people who were made homeless by some of these hurricanes, they're moving back to their land, their devastated land, because they have no place else to go. So they're, you know, pitching tents if they can, living without water and, you know, access to bathrooms. So we don't do enough of looking back to, yes, those were devastating, and then there's the next day's news. So there's a segue for me for this, because you do write about hope, and this show is supposed to be about the true nature of hope and your path, a wandering one from climate awareness to climate anxiety to climate anguish, has taught you about the true nature of hope. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? You say it's become your superpower, and I could use a strong dose of your superpower right now.
Sure. It's a personal path. But I think a lot of us who spend time coming to terms with climate change follow a similar path and end up in a similar place. I spoke in the blog about a dear friend of mine, an Australian climate scientist, who back in, it was around 2008, we were working together on a climate impacts analysis and just processing the news that was coming in. And she told me that she had let go very kind of deliberately of hope, and that she was now working in this post-hope phase, and that she was not sad about this, just very matter-of-fact, and planning to pursue solutions really aggressively without needing that assurance of hope. And I puzzled on that for a long time, and I couldn't make sense of it really until more recently. I found myself, as most people have who deal with climate change, going through the cycles of grief. Back in the late 90s, going to IUCN conferences, World Conservation Union conferences, and hearing leading-edge scientists talk about the future of the reefs, the diminishing future of the world's reefs, the diminishing future of the rainforests and the, you know, miraculous species therein, I began cycling through grief, and I don't think I'll ever stop. We learn more each year, each month, sometimes it feels like each day, about things that are all but lost, some things that are actually lost to us, to this world. And it's hard to come to terms with those, but you can't stay there. This work requires us to move forward. And not to simplify and fast forward through the process that I kind of outlined in this blog, but, you know, there, when I talk about hope, I'm not talking about some optimistic, positive view on the world, really. I'm talking about a gritty, muscular, determined forward movement that you find yourself moving with, and you know, without even really making a choice, without even really deciding, because you care about the people in your life, because you love the people in your life, you love things about this world, and if you have that spark, you can't really do anything else. There is no giving up. And, you know, I think hope gets a bad name because it's seen as this, as I said, sort of, you know, optimistic, positive view on the world. But call it what you will, it's this gut level discipline for survival, really, that I think is much harder to shed than we give it credit for. A lot of people talk about losing hope, and I think those are just the very first stages of coming to terms with climate change. There's a lot to be hopeless about. But there's this... it's actually a little bit... I was worried about this, actually, if you were going to have to edit moments when I just feel a little...
I love those moments. I live for those moments because I'm sitting here on the other end, and the impact you're having is reinforcing what I said yes to. So have the moment, because I'm luckily wasn't the one speaking, so I could have my very private moment. But what you're saying is really the real deal, and it's important. So please go on if you feel like it, and if not, I can certainly ask another question. But nobody has described it to me like that. Nobody. And I'm thinking, this is what I needed today. This is what I needed. And there are many thousands of listeners that listen to our podcasts that they will be saying, yes, yes, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in.
Well, that's kind of you. You know, we all grapple with this in our own way. I found, actually from my childhood, a source of, or an explanation, I think, for this hope, which actually came from an old and ancient Finnish myth. There's this term in Finnish culture, this term sisu, which when I was growing up, my family seemed to embrace it as, you know, this just this courage, guts, bravery. And we celebrated that. It was really, you know, fun to you know, go skiing in the cross-country skiing in the middle of the night in the coldest possible conditions, and, you know, sort of this chest experience. I thought that that's what it was, this thing, this this concept. And I found myself one day painting a cabinet in an apartment I was renting, listening to public radio, and this obscure show started talking about this even more obscure poem, this Finnish epic, the Kalevala. And it's crazy, like all myths, right? But they endure for a reason, right? There are these strange truths to them. And none of what was being said really gripped me until they started to tell the story of this nameless woman and the ordeal that she went through. And it's... She endures beyond all limits of hope in a quest to find her son and to bring him back. And what that entails in this myth is literally finding tiny pieces of him in this black underground river. And it's this grueling story. You know, I found myself just like, oh, cringing listening to it. Like, how is this even something that could be told, you know, through the ages? It's so grim. But she eventually persists and puts him together and sews him back into a whole being, and, you know, gets this tiny gift from the gods of a drop of honey that brings him back to life. And I was so struck listening to that, you know, just my paintbrush kind of drying in my hand, thinking about what that meant and what the real meaning of that term, sissy, that I've been using my whole life was. You know, it's not the guts to get out there and do something. It's this enduring persistence that doesn't need you don't even ask yourself if you're going to keep going, because if you possibly can restore, help the things that you love the most, in this case, the person that you love the most, you don't even question it. You just keep on. And I find that in the hardest moments, thinking about our future and the various doors that have been closed on the things that we, you know, that we love about the world, I return to that, and I return to this notion of, you know, hope really has this unstoppable power, because if you love anything, you're going to keep going.
Well, that certainly anchors me into what it means, and I am sure that I will replay this part of the podcast for me. And I wonder if you feel comfortable responding to this. What happens for me, and this is not like a therapy session, but you are on the front lines and you keep going. So what happens for me is I watched a TEDx talk recently, and this man was explaining why people shut down. Literally, their lizard brain shuts down when it comes to the impact of the dangers of the doom and gloom of climate change. And they just say, you know, I really can't handle it. And what happens to me in my brain is, and I don't say this, but I'm saying it on the air now, get over yourself. Like, don't let your lizard brain shut down, because the life you save may be your own or your child or your grandchild or your neighborhood. So just reactivate the lizard brain, open your eyes, and get in the good fight, because we need you. That's so self-indulgent. And that probably doesn't help. It really doesn't. But let's just say when World War II was declared, and I think this is far worse, and I mean that sincerely, because more people are already dying from starvation and all of those lives that continue to be lost every day through drought and flooding and hurricanes and wildfires. So where I get to the place where I say we are actually in a war, and those people in World War II, they didn't say, my brain can't handle that. You know, my lizard brain is just shutting down and it's too much bad news for me to handle. We need that feeling of a united front, of we're fighting for the planet. And I want to help get people there. And when I'm in that, you know, preaching, get over yourself mode, it doesn't serve anyone. So how do you take that tack on? Because your words give me hope. Your writings give me hope, even if it's not great news. What you're doing does not depress me, and I need to do that.
So how do we keep people in the fight?
Or get them in the fight. It's like everybody needs to be in this fight, because the life you save may be your own. And you know that's true. And you mentioned the heat waves. And what I know, what you know, is people in marginalized communities, people who are on the lower income spectrum, they're hit hardest and will die first because they can't afford air conditioning. They can't just go home and turn the air conditioning up or down. You know, they have to figure out how to breathe.
Yeah, no, it's such a luxury to be unaware or to,
yes.
To shut down. It really is a privilege. It's certainly an incredible puzzle to get people in the fight. We do the work that we do to connect for people their daily lives with climate change. So our most recent work on extreme heat, I'm sure glad that it came out last week when we were...
right?
This week when I'm wearing a sweater in Massachusetts. It really served... I mean, unfortunately, it was very scary. People lost their lives. I don't mean to make light of it.
Yes.
It was an experience of extreme heat days, 2 to 3 of them, depending on where you live, in a row. And our work that was released on Tuesday shows that in the mid-century time frame, so not that far off, depending on where you live in this country, you should expect dozens and dozens of those days. Florida and Texas should expect 50 such days consecutively. 150 of our bigger cities should expect at least 30 days with a heat index over 105. We saw a heat index over 105 in a handful of places for 3-ish days. Imagine 30 of those days each summer, and that's not very far off. We, fortunately, had a lot of things have changed, and the media is covering climate change differently, and we had a lot of just 7 o'clock news coverage making these connections, and that's the kind of magic moment, right, for people that can really change their perspective. People worry about aspects of climate change, and heat is certainly one that tops the list. There's a recent poll that showed that 70% of Americans worry about extreme heat at least a little in their local communities. So our work has focused on the coast, focused on sea level rise, focused on coastal flooding. We've done work on climate change and public health. We do work on wildfires. We're doing some work on drought and water resources. We're laying this, I think, important groundwork, looking at the entire lower 48 states and looking at extreme heat so that we can work over the next couple of years to really continue to make those important visceral connections for people. Some people are on board, and the challenge is to keep them from jumping from, you know, lack of awareness quickly through awareness to hopelessness, right? There's that group of people. And then there's this large segment of the population that is starting to make the connection and starting to become open to acting on climate change. And that's the space that we really need to lean into.
And to your point, it does give me hope that a lot of the national network news is paying more attention. And whereas even 5 years ago, they were laying off climate science reporters, newspapers were not reporting it as much. And I see that as hope. And I think you're right about the tying it to what does it mean to me? And I saw a special in the past 2 weeks where it talked about the impact it's going to have on airport runways. When flights can't fly, and I live in Tucson and Phoenix is much hotter, and flights could not go out of Phoenix last year a couple of days because the tarmac was literally melted. They couldn't move the tires. So it wasn't snow and ice, it was the tarmac. And I've been in conversations and at conferences where they're talking about what the engineers are doing to scramble to come up with new composites that will be impervious to those kind of impacts. So if you're going to fly anywhere, which is another, you know, privileged thing, you're going to be grossly inconvenienced. And so I think that those kind of reporting and translating it to, and they talked about even railroad tracks. So, you know, it's going to impact industry and the price of food and access to so many things. So you're right, there is hope about that. So a perfect segue, and I don't like to do this, but I have to. I feel like I have to, is for 10 years we prided ourselves on we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, and keeping it out of the political conversation. And lately I've been saying, you know what, I've taken the gloves off And that's not what's happening. So almost every day, not almost every day, I get many things in my newsfeed about the current administration either rolling back programs that were good for the planet or policies that were moving us in the right direction. Or in my case, one of my passions are protection of the wolves. Well, forget that, because they're literally going after the wolves. I liken it to ICE. They're finding them and smoking them out and shooting them down. And going after scientists at the EPA, for example, that latest announcement was devastating. You know, you have two places to move and you have X amount of days to decide. And my question is, how much of these policies, one can imagine that it might be short term, that we only have a year and a half left, or less than that. If there is a win for the planet and what that looks like, how much of these administrative changes can hurt us? Are there points of no return from where you sit? Or what should we be looking at to try to preserve, if people listening to this are excited about getting in the fight and they're saying, yes, I have hope, I listened to what Erica said, and I'm going to go after stopping drilling, or I'm going to go after the increasing levels of pesticides. You know, give us where that looks on the hope meter in terms of combating what our own government is doing to the planet and to us.
Where it sits on the hope meter. Well, this has obviously been a terrible, terrible blow to our climate, the climate path that we thought we were on. It wasn't perfect by a long shot, but there was ground being laid. And the rollbacks under this administration are they're just devastating. The economics, though, are running counter to those rollbacks, and what's happening at the state and municipal level is running counter to those rollbacks. It's not enough if we were to have another 4 years of anti-climate leadership.
I can't even think about that.
Let's not. People can engage deeply on all kinds of different fronts. There's no shortage. Find the one that you're passionate about and go. I feel that a really strong climate showing in this upcoming election is perhaps the most important thing we can do. So, you know, look at your candidates, look at where they stand on these issues, and vote for the climate, vote like the future depends on it. We all know it does. And, you know, let's engage around, you know, not just our own getting to the polls, but let's engage on pro-climate work in this 2020 moment.
And I feel like my saying is, we're not voting for a party, we're voting for a planet, and find out who is really going to stand up for the planet. And there's some part of this like esoteric discussion about climate change and blah, blah, blah. Well, climate change is real and happening, and climate change has many faces. And that's what I try to connect with people on that level. I mean, we're having a climate change of heart event in October. And one of the things that's essential is we're going to have people from the League of Women Voters there to sign people up to vote. Not political, not vote for this, just sign up to vote. So I think you're right. I think the most important thing that we can do in terms of the big impact is that. And then an immediate impact, every day I make choices. And then there are those days when I say, what the heck difference does it make if you use a straw or not, Gina? Let's be honest. And then I say, no, you know, that can be the gateway to another step and another step. And that's what I tell people. The small changes lead to a big impact. So thank you for that. And then my next question is about, I am like doing the crazy dance about, I've been submitted to be a delegate at COP25, the Conference of Parties in Chile. And this is, you know, in case people don't know what it is, you know, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is a big mouthful, the UNFCCC, it's the international response to climate change. That's, to me, so easy to say. Everybody knows what it means. And it's a treaty that sets out the basic responsibility of 196 parties, which are states or countries, plus the European Union, to fight climate change. It's really a big deal. And I wonder if you have any reflections that you want to share on, I know why I want to go, because I'm a sponge, and I want to hear what global leaders are saying, and I want to hear about what scientists are doing. Do things like the COP25, do they help have a global impact in this fight for our lives from where you sit?
Absolutely. I mean, the Paris Climate Agreement, despite the less than energized, I guess, stage it's in today, was an incredibly important advancement, right? The global community came together in agreement. We know what's happened since then with the Trump administration pursuing withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement. We know that that has had, that and other countries' own motivations have led to a kind of lackluster pursuit of those commitments by some countries. We know there's a huge gap between where we need to get and where we are. But this is a global problem, and it's only going to be solved at the global level. We, as this giant historic emitter, need to be a leader in that space, but it does need to be that community, that global community, cooperating around this solution. If it's going to, if we're going to bend that curve, if we're going to bring global emissions down. So I'm excited for you that you're going.
And I hope I'm going. My name has just been submitted, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, so many good things have happened for me on this journey. And I just, the University of Arizona has submitted my name as a delegate, because you can't just go. There's too much. Well, you can, but then you have to see what sessions you get in. But I want to be on track. So it's just, and some days I think, so what you're thinking, that this is the world united. It was the world united. My brain clicks in, because it was the world united to take us in the direction of solving the biggest challenges we ever faced as a planet. And then the United States drops out. So that being said, because of the words of inspiration and the work I keep doing, the United States may have dropped out as a titular participant, but there will be hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists from the United States there continuing to do the good work. Do you agree with that? I mean, we're not out.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just a big news deal.
Absolutely. There's so much energy and movement below the federal level, kind of keeping the climate fight here in the country alive. I couldn't agree with that more. It isn't enough without federal leadership over the long term,
right?
But fire is still lit, right?
Right, right. And that's key, over the long term. And there, you know, in terms of things that give me hope, I do a community radio spot for our KXEI. It's a wonderful community radio, and that I'm the green segment. And I interviewed this amazing woman who's become a friend, named Kim Franklin, from the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum. And she's a research scientist. And little things like the monarch butterflies, that's not little. And I want to say, like, I put it in the column of, who doesn't love butterflies? Who doesn't love clean oceans? Who doesn't love clean rivers? And that's my notepad for what I call common ground. Who doesn't love butterflies? I mean, it'd probably be good if you didn't tell me that you're one of those people that doesn't love butterflies, but they just elicit joy. And even if you're not consciously saying, oh, there's a butterfly, it's joy. And Kim said, you know, there's the eastern monarchs that are at such risk, like in Ohio, down 75% over the past 10 years. And then she talked about the Western monarchs, which the Arizona is like a hub for, because we have extreme heat, but we also have extreme altitude. So we're a good stopping ground. And she said something to me that was hopeful. I said, "So Kim, what can we do?" And she said, "Plant milkweed." So when people are looking for hope and one little thing to do, plant milkweed. We're going to plant milkweed in our yard. Plant a couple of pollinator plants that attract, pollinators. And that to me is where the hope lies in getting people. It's like the gateway. It's the gateway into consciousness of you can help preserve the planet by planting milkweed, because that'll help preserve the Western monarchs, and your wildflower garden will help with the bees. So there's little tidbits like that that I think will help, that I try to stay on drawdown. Look what Paul Hawken and his team and Catherine Wilkinson and all those people with drawdown. There are thousands of drawdown projects going on around the world that are helping to draw carbon down. And that's actually been in the news quite a bit. I've seen it on 60 Minutes and some other things. So that's where I look for hope, where, yes, we can actually draw carbon down and certainly not reverse it, but help mitigate it.
Mm-hmm. It's true. If you look around, there are so many reasons, so many beautiful stories, so much hard work, so many individuals and collaborations pushing in the right direction, and on so many different fronts. It is inspiring. And I'm inspired. I think so many of us are, to see the kids who have taken on the climate fight.
Yes.
It's inspiring. It's definitely tinged with sadness. That inspiration, because this isn't something that we would have hoped for these kids, that they are saddled with this fight. But man, they are really a force, and I hope that we can stand behind them when it's the right thing to do, but continue to, you know, hold the line against these dangerous climate futures, not saddle them with these dangerous climate futures. And continue to work as hard as we can to make their challenges manageable.
And so I could not agree with you more. Every year I go to Bioneers, and the number of young people they have speak that get standing ovations about what they're doing, especially in the, you know, the Native people, Indigenous people. It's. I've had a lot of them on my show as guests, and then Joel McCower from Green Biz just did a conference on circularity, which I totally missed, and wrote to him and say, "How did this miss? I was busy paying attention to having our latest granddaughter come about, so that I had my focus somewhere else." But I think that's another area of hope where young children, not just young adults, young children are doing things in their classroom. There's 8-year-olds speaking out on climate. So I'm sorry they have that burden in some ways, because I was probably speaking out about the color of my crayons when I was 8 and not about climate change, but we need them as well. So do you want to speak just briefly? I know this isn't what we were necessarily going to talk about, but you know, two important blogs, and we do have a little bit of time left. Encroaching Tides, How Sea Level Rise and Tidal Flooding Threatens the U.S. East and Gulf Coast Communities Over the Next 30 Years. Can you just give us the overview of what that article addressed and what the findings were?
Sure. We've actually done a lot of work on sea level rise and coastal flooding since that original ground laying piece of work. And we looked at the entire coastline of the lower 48 states, and we asked where and when communities will start to face chronic inundation, so chronic flooding just from high tides. And we found, really surprisingly, that as early as 2030, 2035, we see dozens and dozens of communities that would face dozens and dozens of tidal floods each year, and covering increasingly large areas of usable land. And in our most recent coastal analysis, affecting tens of thousands of homes. And that work was really, I think, important in bringing home for folks just how near-term the sea level rise threat is. We often think about it being something that affects us only if a storm blows through or only late century when places are permanently underwater. But nobody's going to wait to be permanently underwater, right, to have their lives and the value of their home and, you know, their neighborhood and community upended. It's only going to take a chronic level of pressure, of flooding, for our coastal communities to really feel it, to feel the impact, and to face some significant changes. A lot of our work is about helping people see this coming and get out ahead of it with sensible policies. In the coastal zone, a lot of that sensible policy work is about adapting to this change because there's a lot of inertia in the process of rising seas. We're not just going to shut this off. The heat work really allowed us to pivot to a much more empowered message because heat is one of those climate impacts that's really responsive to our emissions. And if we can bend the curve on emissions, even mid-century, we saw really big differences in the number of extreme heat days. So rather than say we're going to face these terrible increases and we need to adapt, our first message with this work, you know, the solution starts and ends with mitigating climate change, with reducing our heat-trapping emissions, and, you know, the first best time to do that was decades ago,
right.
And next best time is right now. This is dangerous heat we're talking about, you know, saddling our kids with summers full of even deadly heat days, and it's not a place we can go. Nobody likes, nobody wants that. We need to see it, and we need to get on it. So, you know, here we are, 2019, a lot to be alarmed about, a lot to be really worried about, but a lot to be really fired up about. This is a critical moment. A lot hangs in the balance. I'm only talking from the perspective of, you know, a middle-aged mom who's been working on these issues. Everybody engaged in this is coming from their own place in life. With their own perspective, they're at their own stage in sort of cycling through what it means to be in the climate fight, what it means to grieve and feel hopeless and get back up and do it again. So we all need to be, you know, making, being kind to ourselves, appreciating that we, humanity, has never been through anything like this. We don't really know how to do this. We're making it up as we go. And the key is really just to stay in it. Give ourselves permission to, you know, feel all of that bad stuff from the anger to the despair and keep at it. Because there really is no alternative.
And that's a perfect way to end with those words of wisdom. And I want to highlight, be gentle with yourself. And I'm saying that to me. Take time out. Go away, be in nature, go up to the higher altitudes, binge watch a favorite TV show, whatever it has to be for you to take yourself off the front lines, do a little triage, and then get right back up. Because you're right, we're in the fight of our lives. And having a granddaughter that's 2 months old, it puts the fire in my belly, I can tell you what. Okay, so a few last words from me. There really are days for me, dark days, when I say to myself, who are you kidding? What kind of difference do you think Mrs. Green's world can make when the battles are raging, the storms keep coming, the oceans keep rising, the people keep starving and losing their homes? Who do you think you're kidding? And I learn about and get to spend time with someone like Erica Spanger Siegfried. Now I'm having my moment. Damn it. She is someone I would say, is on the front lines. She's reading the science of what's happening. She is getting data about the impact of climate change, about what's really happening to our oceans and this great planet of ours. And she keeps on going. She reads the research. She writes the articles. She reaches deep into her soul and finds her superpower and keeps doing the good work, the right work, the important work for herself, her loved ones, for us, and for this great planet of ours. And then I have hope again. And I get up the next morning and I want to be part of all those things because of the work of people like her. Erica, thanks for showing up in my world, in our world, and for all the work that you do to help each of us find our own superpowers, because we are not only all we have, we are it. We're going to need those superpowers in the weeks, months, and years to come. And to all of our amazing listeners, you are my superpower. So thank you for being a part of my world. And Erica, you can tell I'm speaking from the heart. I tore my heart wide open on this one, kiddo. So thank you for helping me.
Thank you, Gina. Thank you for everything you're doing.
It's important stuff. I was excited about the show and we got over all the glitches. So everybody, on August 27th, Tom Zaki, he is a piece of work. He's amazing. He's the CEO and founder of TerraCycle. And we're going to talk about closing the loop, the TerraCycle way. And he's been working on finding ways to recycle everything you can possibly think of on Earth, including cigarette butts and diapers. So I'll leave you with that, and I'll leave with my final thanks to you, Erica, and to all of you who are out there listening. I appreciate all of it. Thanks for being a part of my world.